Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gabe Rotman with the American Civil Liberties Union, who takes a critical look at the Pentagon's Total Information Awareness Program, designed to track all financial transactions by every U.S. citizen. Terry O'Neill, membership vice president of the National Organization for Women, who analyzes the threat to women's rights with the recent Republican takeover of the U.S. Senate, and Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign, who discusses the 2002 congressional election and the dominant role big money plays in determining winners and losers in U.S. politics. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During a recent meeting to negotiate the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, a proposed hemisphere-wide trade pact, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick was in a tight spot. Along with other trade ministers, Zoellick was required to listen to 50 social movement leaders bash the trade deal during a late October meeting in Quito, Ecuador. Once the trade ministers gathered, the activists, farmers, indigenous people, and civil society advocates started to chant, "We don't want to be a North American colony," during which Zoellick was seen staring at his shoes. According to the news magazine In These Times, the Bush administration wants to ratify the FTAA by the end of 2004. The treaty will link the economies of 34 nations of North and South America, excluding Cuba, instituting rules favoring corporations by weakening labor, environmental, and human rights laws. In Quito, over 10,000 activists protested against the FTAA. As Juan Pablo Pancho Maracho, a farmer from southern Ecuador, said, "The FTAA would rob us of security in our work and would allow produce to come in at prices that we can't possibly compete with. It would eliminate our culture." The protests are just the most recent sign of resistance against corporate-led globalization in Latin America. The landslide election in Brazil of the Workers' Party presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and the victory of retired colonel-turned-progressive activist Edwin Gutierrez in Ecuador's presidential contest are the result of a backlash against the Washington consensus. As Ecuadorian campesino leader José Enclada observed, "The FTAA has given us this opportunity to get to know each other and to begin to construct a coordinated resistance across the Americas." In a report released November 8th, Human Rights Watch condemned Colombian Attorney General Luis Camilo Osorio for failing to uphold the prosecutions of human rights violators. Since taking office in July 2001, General Osorio has publicly announced that he would correct the excessive attention paid to human rights violations, especially as it pertained to the Colombian military. He immediately demanded resignations of two high-ranking officials who handled human rights cases, and a third felt compelled to resign as well. José Miguel Vivanco, executive director of the Americas Division of Human Rights Watch, says, "Since Osorio has been in office, five Colombian prosecutors and investigators have been killed in the line of duty. Several prosecutors pursuing investigations against high-ranking military officials were moved or reassigned before they could make arrests. One case cited is the 2001 massacre in the village of Chengue Sucre, in which Navy General Rodrigo Quiñones is implicated. The prosecutor who had made headway on the case was reassigned, and the case has since stalled." The U.S. has provided Colombia with $1.3 billion in military aid over the past 3 years, and the White House is now proposing more aid be funneled to the Army. U.S. law specifically requires that the Colombian military cooperate with civilian justice officials prosecuting human rights cases. Human Rights Watch is asking the Bush administration to make it clear to Colombia that if Osorio's office refuses to take human rights violations seriously, the U.S. will withhold its funding. After decades of poverty and repression, the women of Nigeria's Niger Delta rose up in July. They led a series of militant actions and took over oil fields run by Chevron Texaco, demanding a way out of their misery. The Niger women, who first took over a Chevron tank farm and terminal, had three demands: job opportunities for their children, more local economic investment, and improved infrastructure. The women successfully shut down the oil facility for 10 days, halting the operation, which pumps out 500,000 barrels of oil a day. The siege ended when the oil company signed an agreement with the activists. According to the World Press Review magazine, the militant actions of the women were a wake-up call in Nigerian politics and a stern reminder of the token efforts taken in the past to deal with the massive inequalities in oil-producing regions. At the core of last summer's revolt was the question of who will control Nigeria's vast natural resources and the mismanagement and corruption in exploiting these riches. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
One week before President Bush signed legislation creating the new Department of Homeland Security, several developments in the courts and at the Pentagon served to alarm civil liberties activists across the country. The secret U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review granted the Justice Department sweeping new powers to employ electronic surveillance to prosecute U.S. citizens in criminal matters. But even more alarming to many was the Defense Department's announcement of a new information gathering system called the Total Information Awareness Program. Total Information Awareness is described as a prototype database being developed by the Pentagon to detect patterns indicative of terrorist activity by tracking all purchases made by every U.S. citizen. But progressive and conservative critics of the Bush administration's post-September 11th attack on civil liberties assert that this new program is nothing short of an Orwellian nightmare come true. Further stoking fears of the potential abuse of such a system was the naming of Rear Admiral John Poindexter to head the project. Poindexter, who served as National Security Advisor to President Reagan, was convicted in 1990 of misleading Congress and making false statements in the Iran-Contra scandal, a conviction later overturned on a technicality. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabe Rotman with the American Civil Liberties Union, who discusses concerns shared by a wide spectrum of activists that elements of the Bush administration's anti-terror program threatens critical provisions of the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights.
The Total Information Awareness System, as it's proposed and as it's being developed at the Pentagon, would be, without exaggeration, the most extensive surveillance system in the history of humankind. It would involve using a technology called data mining, which is similar to what the credit card companies use to detect credit card fraud. It would use that, take it to the nth degree, and use it to search through vast amounts of personal data about American citizens to look for patterns that they say will help them predict future behavior, hopefully future terrorist behavior. The problem with it, though, is that on a grand scale, especially this program, again, goes against the American idea that if you're not doing anything, there's no reason for the government to be looking at you. And if it wants to look at you, it's got to have a very good reason, and it's got to go to the courts to justify that. In this case, the TIA poses myriad problems, too numerous probably for us to get into right now, but essentially what it would do is provide the capacity for the government to spy on every American citizen. It is one of those things that shows that, you know, Big Brother, the term Big Brother, which might be cliched, is certainly real, and he lives and he can ruin lives.
What pieces of information do we know that the Pentagon may be trying to assemble in this this pilot or research project?
Well, they actually have on their own website, the TIA program, it's called Total Information Awareness, is actually run out of the office called the Information Awareness Office, which is a part of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as DARPA. The IAO is actually run by John Poindexter, the highest-ranking official in the Reagan administration to be implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal. On their own website, it lists the transactional data, quote-unquote, basically the databases that would be data mined, and it lists financial, education, so grades, travel, medical, veterinary, country entry, if you're going into the United States, if you're going into Britain, wherever, if you're going into a political rally, if you're entering a mosque, if you're entering a synagogue, transportation, housing, critical resources, and government databases and communications. So all of those things they have indicated would be in this massive linked database, integrated database.
Now, this project has not gone into action yet. It's just a research project. But the Pentagon says citizens should really have nothing to fear because they will only look for patterns that indicate illegal or potentially terrorist activity that they would then investigate. Maybe you could explain the ACLU's concerns about this project and the potential for abuse.
It would be one thing if such a thing was infallible, that in fact it did have clairvoyant abilities. But in this case, it doesn't look like that's the case. And actually, the Pentagon is saying something else. They're not arguing as to whether it's infallible or not. They're simply saying, look, we're going to build it. We're going to put the infrastructure together. We're going to design the hardware and the software to provide you with the most extensive surveillance tool in history. And then it will be up to the Congress to implement it in policy. Unfortunately, that runs into a lot of problems. And as we've seen with extensive surveillance systems or cults of surveillance in the past, including the Hoover-era FBI and their smear campaigns against civil rights activists and anti-war activists, most notably the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, that's a problem. When they say, trust us, we're the government, that's problematic because we've seen in the past that that trust is oftentimes misplaced.
There are many people listening who probably don't remember the name John Poindexter. As you said, he was the highest level Reagan administration official to be prosecuted. He got off on a technicality because he was granted immunity from prosecution by Congress in exchange for testimony. But many civil liberties advocates are very worried about John Poindexter, in particular, heading up this research project.
Without passing judgment on Mr. Poindexter, on Admiral Poindexter, there is cause for concern. Admiral Poindexter did indicate that it was his judgment that in protecting the president's national security apparatus, it was his duty to withhold information from Congress. I think that a lot of people outside of the ACLU have had serious questions about the appropriateness of Admiral Poindexter being in charge of such a system that could have such dire consequences for privacy in the United States.
Is there a concern on the part of average citizens about this march toward the erosion of civil liberties? And if so, I mean, are you getting a lot of reaction over at the ACLU, a lot of phone calls, a lot of questions, a lot of offers of support for your campaign to bring public awareness to these issues?
Well, we've certainly seen, especially with the campaign, we've seen a number of average American municipalities passing local resolutions and ordinances, refusing, barring any cooperation as far as legally possible, any cooperation with USA Patriot or with any repressive government policies. And that's pretty widespread. I think we're up to 13 or 14 right now. And it's everywhere from Massachusetts to New Mexico. I think the understanding that we can be both safe and free, that neither need suffer with the other, I think that that is becoming more pervasive. I think the idea is crystallizing at least in the mainstream, certainly.
That was Gabe Rotman, Media Relations Associate with the American Civil Liberties Union. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 202-546-9375 or visit their website at www.aclu.org. Since George W. Bush has been in office, his attacks against women's reproductive freedoms have been relentless. His first official act was to cut the $34 million in funding for the United Nations Population Fund, which would have assisted poor women in preventing unintended pregnancies and controlled the spread of sexually transmitted diseases and HIV/AIDS. Bush proclaimed January 20, 2002, National Sanctity of Human Life Day, likening the terrorism of September 11th to abortion. He now wants to appoint right-wing religious activist Dr. David Hager, who is working to overturn the FDA's approval of mifepristone, more commonly known as RU486, or the abortion pill, to the FDA's influential Reproductive Health Drugs Advisory Committee. In October of this year, the Bush administration issued regulations making fetuses, but not their pregnant mothers, eligible for health care coverage under the State Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. The fate of Roe v. Wade, the historic 1973 ruling which legalized abortion nationwide, now rests in the hands of a conservative Supreme Court. With the GOP takeover of the U.S. Senate, Republicans now have the power to confirm Bush administration nominees, bolstering the ranks of anti-choice justices. Terry O'Neill is the membership vice president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, based in Washington, D.C. She spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about how Republican control of all three branches of government could quietly but relentlessly reverse nearly 30 years of progress in women's rights, especially reproductive freedoms.
Trent Lott, now in charge of the Senate, has announced gleefully that he will be working very hard to ram through, first of all, the vaginal abortion ban. I can tell you that what this law does, and by the way, this is virtually identical to the state law that was ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court, but this is a law that Trent Lott loves, and he wants to enact a federal version of a law that bans virtually all of the safest and most common vaginal abortion procedures. And they will tell you that this is about late-term abortions. That's false. It is fascinating to see how they can claim in the media and actually get believed by mainstream news organizations that this applies late-term, and yet in their court papers, where they're not allowed to lie, they admit, in fact, they declare that from the moment of conception, a fertilized egg is a baby, and that if an abortion involves the vagina, it involves the birth canal, and that makes it all partial birth. And so from the moment of conception on, these procedures are, in their view, can be criminalized. And George W. Bush will continue his assault on women's contraception rights, as well as women's rights to obtain safe legal abortion.
The military is being geared up by George Bush, perhaps inspections or no inspections, regardless of the results, to invade Iraq. And that will no doubt mean that women serving in the military will be serving abroad once again. But President Bush has extended this to women in the military as well, in terms of curtailing their reproductive and contraceptive freedoms if they happen to be abroad. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Women who are putting their lives on the line to serve their country, if they happen to be overseas and they're military women, or if they are the wives or daughters of military men who are living overseas, they are forbidden to go to an Army medical facility to obtain an abortion, even if they can pay for it themselves, which means that if a woman needs an abortion and she is in the military or she's a military dependent living overseas, she would have to go to a local facility to obtain the abortion. Now, just picture if she's in Saudi Arabia, okay, where abortion is flat out illegal. Her options are extremely limited and quite scary.
What is now prepared to do? What should people listening to this program do to prevent that?
The right wing, since the early 1980s, the right wing has had a long-term goal of a full takeover of our otherwise independent federal judiciary. They want ideologues on the court. The Ronald Reagan and Bush the First pursued that goal of putting extremist ideologues on the court who would be opposed not only to women's rights, but to civil rights, to affirmative action, and to civil liberties. They have had remarkable success. What the Republican leadership did during the Clinton administration was shut down the judicial appointments process to severely limit the Democratic president's ability to make appointments to the court. And remember that Clinton was, in fact, a moderate Democrat who, to the degree he got people onto the court, they're moderates. George W. Bush has been, if anything, more aggressive than his father in getting right-wing ideologues into the federal courts. And I'm sorry to say that he has had enormous success. We have managed to stop some of it when the Democrats were in control of the Senate, but it is looking quite bleak. We are very concerned about a full-scale extremist right-wing takeover of the United States court. And remember that, just a little civics lesson, the whole point of checks and balances is part of a fundamental aspect of democracy is you need to have an independent judiciary, a bunch of judges who will, in fact, rule on the law without regard to their own ideological biases. And what we have is a president who is determined to pack the courts with men and women who cannot and will not put their own biases aside, who will, in fact, rule on the basis of their ideology and not on the basis of the rule of law. So we have been working very hard to stop that part of the right-wing juggernaut. We are organizing, organizing, organizing. We are stepping up our efforts in local communities. We are doing absolutely everything that we can the best way that we do, which is local chapter, now chapter activism. And we know that we're going to have, or we expect we're going to have, a huge fight over the Supreme Court at some point in the future, and we intend to be ready for it with our chapter organizing.
That was Terry O'Neill, Membership Vice President of NOW. For more information, contact NOW at area code 202-628-8669 or visit their website at www.now.org. The 2002 midterm congressional election was the last federal ballot to be conducted without the McCain-Feingold ban on soft money. The campaign finance reform bill, which was signed into law earlier this year, does not go into effect until the next election cycle. But many advocates of reform point out that the two major political parties have been hard at work to find loopholes in the new law, allowing big donors to continue their dominance of U.S. politics. Following the pattern established over many decades, candidates who spent the most money in 2002 overwhelmingly won their races with very few real contests for congressional seats. Public Campaign, a national organization committed to winning comprehensive campaign finance reform, contends that full public financing of elections is one of the key reforms necessary to restore confidence in the U.S. electoral system. Fewer than 40% of registered voters bothered to cast ballots in November's election, underscoring Public Campaign's contention that without meaningful electoral reform, the public will continue to lose faith in America's democracy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nick Neihardt, executive director of Public Campaign, about the impact of big money in the recent election, the barriers to campaign finance reform, and some recent successes at the state level.
In federal elections, last cycle, there was about $500 million in political party soft money, and that includes all the money spent on the presidential campaign. This time around, with several weeks left, they were already at $420 million without a presidential campaign to pay for with soft money. So we'll probably see the record of $500 million last year eclipsed without even a presidential race to run.
The McCain-Feingold bill, I know some campaign finance groups and individuals were actually opposed to it because, remind me about this, it banned soft money, but it increased the amount of money that you could give.
It doesn't even ban soft money. What it does is not allow political parties and their committees, like the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee or the Republican equivalent or the similar committees in the House of Representatives federally, it forbids them from collecting these huge checks, the unlimited checks that were then used for party building or issue advocacy, what often people call sham issue advocacy, that is television ads that come on during elections that pretend to be about issues but are really about switching votes from one candidate to another. And it just says you can't do those kinds of checks to the party committees. You can do them elsewhere. Although, if you want to write a large check out to an issue group that's going to go do that, or a made-up group that's going to go spend that money, we will restrict those groups from being able to use television and radio ads that use the candidate's name or likeness in the last 60 days before an election. But that means every other means of communicating with voters is fair game. And so you'll see those big checks written. They'll just go into telephone calls and field staff and direct mail and billboards and ads that don't use the candidate's name or likeness but refer to the rest of the campaign that's being run through those other means. So it doesn't really ban soft money. On the hard money side, as a compromise to pass banning soft money, they doubled the contribution limits for what individuals can give to candidates. So it vastly increases the fundraising capacity of well-heeled candidates who have a good network of special interests to go to. So there's a loophole-riddled approach on the soft money side, and getting the money out of the parties is a good thing. That's a positive step. But there's still ways around that. And then on the hard money side, the problem will actually be worse next cycle because of McCain-Feingold passing.
It can get pretty discouraging. It seems like people are always going to find ways to put money into the campaigns that they want to put money into. But I know that there were a few states, and I think Arizona is probably the furthest along, where they passed campaign finance at the state level. And from a couple different reports I've heard, it sounds like it's actually had a positive impact.
In Maine and Arizona, there were 137 candidates between the two states elected, including the new governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, who were elected without having to go through the private money chase for private contributions. They didn't have to attend fundraiser after fundraiser, cozying up to special interests and basically indebting themselves to those interests. Instead, they were out there full-time campaigning, reaching out to voters. And they ran under what in both states are called clean elections laws. Under those laws, candidates who raise a large number of small contributions, in Janet Napolitano's case, it was $4,005 contributions from people who live in their district or their state. You raise that amount of money in those $5 checks, and then you agree not to take any other private money, to limit your spending to the amount of your public grant. You then get public financing for your race, and you go ahead, and that's your race. You don't go out and raise more money. If your opponent raises more money than your amount, you get matching funds up to about double the original amount. So what this meant was when Janet Napolitano's opponent, Republican opponent Matt Salmon, had the president come in and campaign for him and raise money for him, every time he raised another dollar, Napolitano got matching funds. So it took away that extra advantage of having somebody from the outside pull together the special interests for you. So she ran a level playing field with Matt Salmon and then won in a very close election.
Some people think that that's the way to go because it's already been successful in a few states, but there's 50 states and that could take a while to go state by state. Is your organization supporting any specific legislation now at the federal level?
Yeah, at the federal level, there has been the Tierney bill sponsored by John Tierney and co-sponsored by 50 other lawmakers in the House, and the Kerry Wellstone bill in the Senate. It would do essentially the same thing that we've seen work at the state level. I think we need to build more momentum at the state level, and we also need to look at winning full public financing for the presidential race.
That was Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign. Contact the group by calling area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at www.publiccampaign.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.